PDPods present the PD Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the PD Podcast. I'm your host, Pranay Budev, consultant pediatric orthopedic surgeon from the United Kingdom. Firstly, I'd like to thank our listeners as we crossed over 4,000 downloads after our last episode with Professor Michael Millis. Before releasing some new episodes with upcoming content discussing COVID and its change in practice in pediatric orthopedics, I decided to release an episode I recorded earlier this year at the Burn Hip Symposium. As a pediatric orthopedic surgeon with training in hip preservation, it was an absolute delight to sit with Dr. Ernie Sink, who is chief of the hip preservation unit at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, United States. In this discussion, we speak about his early drive towards surgery for someone that seemed to be quite squeamish in his earlier days, to developing a practice involving fellowships around the United States, but also to Bern, where he spent some time with Professor Gantz. We get to learn about his interest in research and what drives him in that field, why he feels it's important to have a unit that treats a child's hip from birth up until adulthood, and where he feels the field of hip preservation will be in the future. I truly hope you enjoy this episode, and please remember to tune in on the first and third Sunday of each month. Please comment, like and subscribe and share these episodes, and please let me know what you're thinking if there are any guests that you feel you would like to hear from. The goal of this podcast is to all learn collectively to inspire, educate and innovate within our field. Let's now get into the episode. I'm delighted to be sitting here with Dr. Ernie Sink, who's the Chief of Hip Preservation at the Hospital of Special Surgery in New York. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about your career and your views on pediatric orthopedics.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Can you start off and tell me what really led you towards orthopedics, pediatric orthopedics, and hip preservation in general?
Well, I mean, I was when I was in college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I told my dad I was thinking of becoming a philosophy major at the University of Colorado, and he's like, I don't know if that's a good career path. So I was on the ski team and interested in athletics and interested in sports, and I thought maybe I would do some sports psychology. I really didn't have an idea what I wanted to do the first couple of years when I went to University of Colorado. I just no idea, really. And I just took the required courses the first 2 years. But I'd always had this thought that something would always show up in front of me. And that's the way it's been my whole career. Like, I would just put one step foot in front of the other and do the next thing. And then it would be apparent which way I needed to turn following, you know, whatever was in my gut. And so, and I didn't even realize that was sort of my dictum of, you know, how I make choices or my career until, you know, I was down the path and realized, wow, that these decisions have been obvious right in front of me. So just going back to that, so I had to take a, I decided to do biology just to get my required courses at University of Colorado, and I had to dissect a fetal pig. I had up till then avoided any dissection in high school and college because the thought of that would make me pass out, and my family used to make fun of me that the last thing I would be is a doctor. So I remember that day, and I had my other lab colleague do the dissection, and I was avoiding touching. But towards the end, I found it interesting and then decided, actually, I really like biology and I like physiology. So I became a biology major and then took anatomy, which was a cat at the time. And before I knew it, I was like a tutor for anatomy, carrying a cat around in a bag at University of Colorado, tutoring people, because I just found it easy to do anatomy and I loved every part of it. So that was my interest. And I said, well, I think I'm going to go to medical school and I will go observe an orthopedic surgeon one day in Boulder. And I watched him do knee surgery. And I was worried about, I read on how to not pass out and things like that. And I left and I said, well, I think I want to do medicine. And that was 3 out of my 5 years in college because I skied for the ski team. So at the time when I made the decision, I had to do some labs. So I really had no, so in Colorado, also 5 years is a good time to be there. It's a great school in Boulder. So I skied for the ski team and then became a biology major and decided to go to medical school, like I said, 3 out of the third year. So then I took a year off and applied to different schools. I was living in the mountains, driving ambulances and putting on casts and living in Vail, and then decided that I would go to Texas Southwestern. When I was interviewing, it just appeared that they had just a good feeling about it. My interview was a surgeon, and he just put his arm around me after like 5 minutes of talking. He says, well, we'd like you to come here. So I moved from Colorado to Texas and then spent the next 9 years there. So
you did your residency in Texas, is that right?
Yeah, so I stayed in Dallas because I just like the group of residents that I worked with. You know, it was a kind of place where back then the camaraderie and the teamwork was what really attracted me to it. And my residency mates from back then, we just worked together and we're still close. I just saw one last month and it's like we just picked up where we left off and we're all friends, the five of us. Because they get together a lot more, four of the five, than I can see them, but I still, you know, that group was like being in the bunker together at Parkland Hospital for years. It was fantastic. And I think I learned the concept of hard work there and with the skiing when I was a kid in this ski school in Vermont, you know, so those two things, the hard work there and my high school upbringing about being a student athlete, really kind of set up the work ethic for everything.
And then what led you to doing orthopedics? Because you did a couple of pediatric orthopedic centered fellowships. So who led you towards that?
Basically I decided that I loved everything in medical school and I just loved anatomy. So then I chose orthopedics. I just really loved anatomy. I was the last one in the lab. I just, everything about it. We had a full cadaver. I would just spend hours there. I just loved it. And it was easy. I'm like, it was the easiest course because it's just right in front of you. It's obvious. So with that, I decided to do orthopedics. And then I thought I would go and be the sports fellow at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic, you know, because I lived in Vail. I did a little research with them and I thought I'm going to be and at UT Southwestern, they always sent somebody to Vail. And it's a great place. And I was doing my rotation in Dallas at Texas Scottish Rite Hospital as a third year. And it just blindsided me. I loved it. I mean, first of all, the mentors at TSRH are, you know, fantastic. The people there, you know, Tony Herring, you know, John Birch, Charlie Johnston, Lori Carroll, who I first rotated with. I mean, there was just such wonderful people and mentors, and I just loved being there. And I loved the fact that I think I remember back then that they could put up a hip x-ray and just not know what's going to happen. Like it's reduced and then it develops perfectly, or it's going perfectly and then it doesn't end up that way. So there's this unknown about the plasticity of how something develops, and how that fascinated me. It wasn't just there's an injury, fix it, or there's a, you know, an MRI finding, fix it. There's this dynamic ability for the pediatric body to heal and change that just fascinated me. And I think we would research a case and we'd have like it set up, and they have this amazing Monday conference, and you know, you'd have a life of a child in front of you when you're trying to do surgery in an adolescent. And I just really loved pediatric orthopedics. I started buying the pediatric orthopedic ties, the goofy ties and the Christmas ties, and I was wearing them proudly. I wonder if I still have those. But And I had a mother say to one of the attendings one time, and in front of me, she said, "I've seen residents over the years, but this one right here just seems to, this seems like his niche." And I'll never forget the room I was in and everything. And then I just decided I was going into peds ortho. It was like I said, it was just right in front of me. It was the right decision at the time.
And you went to San Diego, is that right?
Yeah, so I had back at, I think the year that I became a did the fellowship, there was like 12 of us. Oh, wow. I mean, it wasn't a lot of us, mm-hmm. right? So coming from TSRH, I remember Charlie Johnson saying, "Well, you should go elsewhere." You know, you had I was out for a little bit with a surgery, and I came back and got to do an extra 6 weeks at TSRH as a chief, which was great. And so they were like, "You should just go elsewhere." So I just remember running around a lake, and I couldn't, because with 12 of us, we had a choice at that time. There wasn't really a match. You just called the, "Do you want to come here?" And I was fortunate enough to kind of go in between a couple places. And I remember I was, there's just something about the program in San Diego, and I think wanting to just go to California for a year. Mm. I grew up in the East Coast. I was in Texas, and California was just the place I'd never been. And I also liked the fact that I felt, even though I was at Parkland, that I needed a place where I had some more autonomy to just feel a sense of my own responsibility, which they did really well. So I went to San Diego, and it was an awesome decision and awesome choice. And, you know, to this day, they're still friends and mentors.
And you then did an AO fellowship that brought you to Bern, which is where we are right now at the HIP Symposium, and you had the opportunity to work with Professor Gantz, which
yes.
I'm sure has greatly influenced your practice.
It has.
So tell me about your time with him, and if you have any stories about him, that would be great.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, how did I end up there is when I was at San Diego, I found myself interested in HIPs with Dennis Winger. I mean, I just was fascinated by it, and I started my practice. And I didn't do an AO fellowship right away. So when I started it, I went back to Colorado, and I was there for a couple years, and I sort of liked scoliosis. They needed me to do sports medicine, so I did a bunch of sports medicine, but not doing a fellowship. I just didn't feel comfortable. And then I remember Mark Erickson, the chief at that time at Pediatric Orthopedics, said, "You seem to love the hip. Whenever a hip's shown up, your eyes brighten." And that's the case. I mean, I really was like, well, I don't think Scully is going to click right now just because of the timing, and Mark's career was exploding because he's such a good surgeon. And I just fascinated with the hip, and there was nobody that specialized in hip. So I visited Mike Millis first, who's our distinguished guest here. I can't wait to hear his talk. So Mike, a friend of mine, Min Coker, said, "You need to go see what Mike Millis is doing." So I went to visit Mike for a couple days, and he did something called a surgical hip dislocation for FAI. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty interesting. And I remember going back to my group and discussing it with them, and they were just like, what, they're dislocating hips? And I was like, yeah, there's this guy, you know, this Professor Gans, that osteotomy, and apparently he dislocates hips, and he can do it safely. And they're like, wow, that's crazy. So I went back and visited Mike Millis for another 2 weeks, and I stayed at the Coker House that had become good friends, and I watched him do PAOs and surgical dislocations. And at first I was like, well, I can do a surgical dislocation, but a PAO is way too complex. But Professor Millis just breaks it down into steps, and I thought, if I can do one step, I can do the next step. And this is something I tell young surgeons. If you think about the case of a PAO, it's so hard. If you just break it down into each step, then you're done. Does that make sense? So You start with the approach. Okay, I got that down. And so after I visited Mike, I came back and did a couple dislocations and a couple PAOs with a colleague of mine, Mike Dayton, who is the residency director out of Colorado. And he had done a fellowship in Boston. So the two of us decided to get through the learning curve, we would do these together. So we did a handful of PAOs and surgical dislocations, and fortunately they went well. But then I realized I needed to come to Bern, you know, because everybody had spent 3 months right after their residency with the AO fellowship. And I hadn't done that. So I contacted, through Mike Millis, I contacted Professor Gans, and he said that it's possible. And being in practice, I only had a month to come. So I applied for the AO Fellowship and came. And it happened to be, it was in here in Bern. I spent a month at the end of July, beginning of August. And it was Gans's last month as the chief. So I was, in effect, one of the last people to rotate with him. And it was amazing. I became a different surgeon. So I was here. I'm watching him over his shoulder perform surgical dislocations and just one or two PAOs that time. And just watching him operate, I truly changed how I used my hands. He's an amazing surgeon. Just how he uses the knife and holds tissues and protects tissues and understands anatomy was life-changing for me. So I actually tell a lot of fellows, like, listen, you're doing one case, but you should sit back and watch a good surgeon do something and watch how their hands are, how they're thinking, because this is your opportunity to see it, you know? So I came back from that 4 weeks here as a technical surgeon better, and changed how I did the approach, how I approached muscles, how I approached soft tissues. That's the one thing about that I remember the most. I certainly remember learning how to do the surgical dislocation because he had tons of them. And his approach for total hips at that time was amazing. He had some crazy cases where he removed HO, and just his knowledge of anatomy. The one thing he always taught is just, you gotta understand the anatomy 100%. And the technical ability to observe was, I feel very fortunate and lucky to be here at that time. And then some of the people that were working under him, Michael Lunig and Martin Beck, are now on their own places and friends that we visit and talk all the time. And I can't believe that I am sitting here as faculty, you know, 16 years later, when I was just this young person trying to learn it. I mean, it's unbelievably fortunate. And I feel like I happened to be with a series of people where hip preservation was just getting started, and I happened to be right on that wave and just lucked out, because I just, you know, I was interested in it right when it was beginning. And so that really helped, I think, academically. It helped my practice. So the month here was, I stayed right across the street from where we're sitting now, and I pointed out to Ira Zaltz this morning as we're walking from the hotel to the meeting. I said, well, I took this walk every night for dinner, because I would go sit outside and eat dinner, and I was every evening, and then I would go back to the hotel and then do surgery that day and watch and see him in the clinic. And it was just a wonderful time. We looked at x-rays, you know, he explained the x-rays, but a lot of it was early impingement stuff. So that was what we focused on that time.
And you rode that wave of sort of the young hip preservation sort of coming through the ranks, and you ended up at HSS, where you're now chief of the department. But your practice is slightly unique in the sense that you treat children and also into adolescents and into young adults.
Definitely.
So tell me, what does your clinical practice sort of case-wise sort of entail? I know you do lots of PAOs, obviously, but you still do DDH hips and things like that?
Yeah, so I think I think being able to subspecialize in hip preservation has really helped. It helps me teach, it helps my practice, it helps my research, it helps me to master the few things that I do. So I treat ages birth through the 40s, let's say. And so I'm part of the pediatric orthopedic service and the hip preservation service. So any baby open reduction, I try to be involved in, and all the Pavlik's, DDH, you know, some Perthes and Skiffy. The Perthes and Skiffies, probably they see more at Boston and CHOP than we do, but we still get plenty, and I really enjoy that. The practice has, because of the referral in HSS and the sports service that does a lot of hip arthroscopy per year, it's become very dysplasia oriented. So now the volume of PAOs is 90 to 100 for the last couple of years, all ages, you know, from 10 to in their 40s. And what's amazing is whether they're 42 or where they're 11 or 12, and I'm talking to the parents, it still seems like the same conversation. I'm still talking about dysplasia. I'm still talking about the natural history. The surgery is the same. There's little differences in the older and younger pelvis, but it's the same anatomy and the same process, the same natural history, the same, the age recovers differently. But I don't feel like I have my adult hat and I have my pediatric hat. I feel like I have my hip hat on. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I just preserve or enjoy hips, whether it's the baby hip reduction, the revision hip reduction in the morning, and then a PAO in the afternoon. To me, it's the hip. Some are bigger, some are smaller. The people you talk to are, it's amazing that we're so fortunate, because I truly think you have to, it's the ultimate being a doctor. You have to listen, you have to exam, you have to, sometimes it's not so clear. So the exam, listening, talking about their problem, looking at different x-rays to come up with what's the best treatment plan is really quite complex. And it makes it fascinating because you get to know the people so well.
And why do you think it's so important to have that continuum?
Yes.
Because I guess, you know, a lot of the babies, you want to follow them up because they may have dysplasia as well, or the sequelae of Perthes and Sufi tend to cause femoracetabular impingement. Yes. And things like that. So as the lead of that service, how important do you think it is having those sort of centers? Because there are not many of them around the world that are as specialized as you.
Yeah, so I think it helps. For example, because of my approach for PAOs, I find the baby hip approach to be a lot easier. It's the same approach. The anatomy's all there. I can get more medial than I used to. And I think the key to the open reduction of a hip in a child is just the approach in the anatomy. And after all the PAOs, it's very easy. Plus, I realized that with the comprehensive care, like when you see a five-year-old and it looks fairly good, you know that it still may not be where you want to be at skeletal maturity, because I've seen it. I've seen the whole book. And if I just stopped at age 18, I would sort of miss of what a open reduction hip looks like at age 30. A small femoral head deformity or a slightly high trochanter from Perthes. We talk about how to treat Perthes, but you know, usually they get better for a while. And then when they show up in their 20s, it's because of the remnants of Perthes. So you understand from the beginning to the end. And I think it just gives you a better three-dimensional knowledge of the disease process.
And are you involved at all in the subsequent arthroplasty for patients who end up with degenerative changes?
No, but being part of the hip preservation service we have at HSS, we have arthroplasty people, we have radiologists, sports medicine. And I really enjoyed the relationships with those subspecialties. And just, I talk about arthroplasty and cases all the time with my adult arthroplasty colleagues. And I've learned things like extra-articular impingement from their knowledge about the trochanter and causing a dislocation. You know, we're now looking at pelvic incidence and how stiff the hip is, and does this affect FAI or dysplasia and the correction? Well, they're the ones that I talk to about how they change their implants because of the possibility of a stiff spine. So having, you know, being at HSS and having all orthopedists, you can learn from every one of them, and it's just fascinating. But I do think it's important, this comprehensive hip thing is important, because I think you can see how things develop. And I think my adult practice helps my pediatric practice, and my pediatric practice helps my adult practice. And for example, this week I'm seeing somebody that I did an open reduction on when they were a child. And we're operating this week because she has residual dysplasia. You know,
yeah,
she had an open reduction, she had a Pemberton, and still has residual dysplasia. You know, it's not just I did the Pemberton and they went off and moved and graduated and I don't know what happens to them anymore. So that's fascinating. I mean, I first met her when she was a baby and now she's a teenager.
You're at HSS, which you know is a very well-known hospital, voted number one for orthopedics in the US many years over. And I saw you give a fantastic talk yesterday where you showed a picture of your weekly MDT.
Yes.
There were 30, 50 people in there. It was amazing to see. Tell me a bit about the hospital, about the orthopedic service there in general, and also has a very strong ortho residency and fellowship program. And I know you're used to be involved as a fellowship director there.
Yes.
So tell me a bit about that as well.
Well, it's amazing having 120 orthopedic surgeons that are all good at what they do. I mean, the pediatric service, the surgeons there are fantastic. The sports they do, I mean, the hips, the CP, and so I work with those colleagues on a daily basis, and they just seem to do the right thing. And it's the same thing with the adults. If you look at, so the hip preservation service, you saw that picture. So complex cases, we present on Wednesdays, and you have everybody from physical therapy to arthroplasty to sports, and we just try to help each other out with complex cases. And that's just it's just amazing the camaraderie in the hip preservation service, which I think is one of the most, has one of the best translational working groups in the hospital. Everybody works together. We all, you know, it can be competitive in York. I mean, you have different services have 20 people doing the same thing. But on the hip preservation service, we refer to each other because if they need a femoral osteotomy through a nail, you know, my partner Bob Boley is really good at it. If they need a hip arthroscopy, since I don't do that, I just send it to one of my hip arthroscopy colleagues. We do a scope PO, do them together. If I need a second opinion, it's just really easy. I can do it at that conference. I can, if I'm deciding whether it's too far arthritic, and let's say a skiffy that's 28 that we're considering a surgical dislocation, I'll send it to my hip arthroplasty colleagues and get immediate feedback on what their thing is. So that's the great thing about being in the hospital. And the one thing about the hospital, I mean, is it really takes care of patients well. Being an orthopedic only hospital, you can focus on orthopedics only. And whether it's the person, and this is true, was told to me when I went there, but whether it's a person that greets you at the door, the surgical tech or the nurse on the floor, they're all doing the same thing. They're all providing orthopedic care, and they're all very proud of being there. You know, the administration is set up so we have direct communication. And the thing that makes, I think it's so great, is you feel like you have autonomy. You feel everybody's trying to work for the best care of the patient. And that's the way the service is. And it's just amazing that we all, how we work together to really find, if somebody comes through the door, it's not that I only know how to do PAO, so that's what they're going to need. I mean, we really are trying to create this algorithm that we haven't really written down, but we talk about it all the time. Like some of the hip arthroscopists won't touch certain things because they're worried about anterior instability, and the x-ray looks fairly normal, and they're not going to make a go for it. They'll send it to me and get my opinion, and we talk about it on the phone, like I did yesterday here at the meeting. Between talks, I talked to one of my partners about a patient. So I just, the center, it's a great place for orthopedic care. And having an orthopedic-only hospital really allows us to specialize in just those problems, whether it's nursing on the floor or research. The residents there, so we have a hip preservation fellow, which is usually done in another residency, and they've all been fantastic. There's a couple here now. And the residents, when they're interested in hip preservation, I don't think I would have ever gotten into the residency. They're so smart. They can put a randomized control study on my desk without me knowing it and say, hey, can you be the PI on this? And it's written beautifully. I'm like, yeah, sure.
That takes us really nicely into your involvement in research, because obviously you're part of the medical advisory board for the International Hip Dysplasia Institute. You're part of the ANCHOR study group. And actually, you've had some pretty seminal papers on non-accidental injury and things like femoral shaft fracture management for AAOS. So what do you enjoy most about research, and how do you incorporate it into your practice?
Well, I think what I enjoy most about research is just answering a question. What I try to do, or what I tell people, is there's some questions we don't have an answer to. And it's just simple management things. Like, for example, scope PAO versus just PAO, right? It's just confusing what to do. And so me and a resident wrote up a paper that was in AJSM that said, you can do it safely, because we've been doing it since I got there, Brian and I, and we were one of the first ones. He'd scope it, and then I'd do the PAO. And we looked at the series and said, well, it can be done safely. And at this point, there didn't seem to be a big difference between the two groups. So I felt like that study, because we have a registry. We have a hip preservation registry that's been going on for 10 years. And so I can, just ask a question like, do older people, do people in their 40s do as well as people in their 20s? And we have the registry, and I can get the information. So one of my research things is to try to come up with answers that help us on a day-to-day basis about taking care of patients. Okay, so for example, one of the things I want to do now is decide who doesn't do well. Not how well everybody's doing, but the big project now is, okay, who is the 10 to 15% that you worry 80% of the time about? And who are they? What specifically about that group can we find out? For example, is there any common theme? And if there isn't, well, there isn't. And you just have to be honest with patients. So just like I've written on the complications and stuff, I mean, those are the things that affect you and affect patient care on a day-to-day basis. So the complication scenario helped define complications and take the, like the dindoclavian, it takes the gut out of it and the emotion out of it. It's just a number, right? And it's how much it affects a patient and how much you have to pay, or you know, what kind of effort do you need to go to manage the complication? What are the complications of surgical dislocation? What are they of PAOs? And then the other thing is that, like I said, next, who doesn't do well? Because what I want to do is try to understand the things that we have to decide clinically that affect us day to day, whether it's scope PAO versus not scope PAO, modern surgical dislocation in the current era, that's the next thing. Like, how are they doing? The old series, but now with hip arthroscopy, who are they in? When do we use it? So those kind of things to help answer simple questions. I did a lot of femur stuff because I happened to be in Denver where there was, you know, 8 femur fractures from ski areas. And then one of the guys, Steve Morgan, said you should do submuscular plating in these complex fractures because we'd gone too far with the TENS nails. And so I did submuscular plating and did a series and presented at POSNA. And I remember coming off the, you know, nobody ever seen it, and I give Steve credit for the idea, and that's how I got into research, because it was something new, it solved a problem, and I got off the podium, and one of my mentors, Peter Waters, said, you should do a bunch of stuff on this for a while. So what I tell the residents and fellows is, do research on the stuff you see. Like, I'm not going to write this. When I started my practice, I wasn't going to write the paper on scoliosis that changed things. But I saw a lot of complex femur fractures, and we found out a way to treat the complex ones, and then just studied that for a while. And then that got me to meetings, and I could do talks, and I could meet friends. And so when I subspecialized, I had more of a forum to do the research. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I love about research is it allows me to be an academic orthopedic surgeon, and it allows me to have friends that are in other places, like this meeting, that are lifelong friends. Mm-hmm. So I think the thing I love about most about research and going to meetings is the friendships. I like learning and hearing, but you know, every time I give a talk, I learn tons, and I spend so much time doing it. But in the end, it's the friendships that's great about research.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other thing is, you come to these meetings and you hear of really novel things, and there's a really exciting future for hip preservation. Where do you think we're going to be in 10, 20 years in hip preservation? Where do you foresee the future, either in training people how to do it, or in new interventional methods, or even imaging methods?
Yeah, so that's a great question that I probably would need to reflect more on to give a very, you know, defined answer. But I think it's grown a lot. Right now, hip preservation is this meeting 10, 15 years ago was fascinating because this whole FAI and surgical dislocation and early response, it was brand new. Now we've gone through that newness, and we have to figure out, you know, it's becoming a more routine specialty with the history, although it's very young. So in 10 to 15 years, I think hopefully we will define who benefits from surgery and who doesn't, right? It's, as I said yesterday in the meeting, the dysplasia was more probably worse than we see now. Now it's people come in with athletes with hip pain and they have a little dysplasia and it doesn't get better with therapy, so occasionally we'll use the PAO to manage a pain as a pain surgery. So one, we got to see how in 10 to 15 years, what is the response to that? How long are these, you know, non-traditional, you know, the original dysplasia series presented yesterday were really severe dysplasias. The one now, they're maybe more different. So I'm curious to see and follow these patients for 10 to 15 years and see if our outcomes are better because we're better at the surgery, our indications are more refined, and perhaps it is hopefully a surgery that it will last longer and longer. We also have to think about our arthroplasty colleagues, because as arthroplasty improves, maybe there's cases that we would have done five years ago that it's just not worth putting the person through it, because an arthroplasty is now a lifetime event. You know, so you always have to. You're probably not going to go as much older ages in some diseases that we know are arthritic, but there's going to be still a role for it. And I think clarifying what is the surgical dislocation role, what's the PAO role, and what's the hip arthroscopy role is what's important. Because I think at our center, we've kind of backed off on some of the hip arthroscopy, and they've sent it to me for open. And then the other thing we certainly need to do through research is to find who can just get better with non-operative treatment. So I think we'll just continue to evolve to more, the indications be better, have a better understanding of our outcomes, and also we're spending a lot of time on expectations and specifically getting to know our patients and what is the right treatment for each individual.
And finally, you know, you're living in New York City, you've got a really busy practice. Mm-hmm. Physician wellness is starting to become quite a big topic, hot topic around. How do you manage your work-life balance?
Yeah.
What do you do to relax? Are you still skiing these days?
Yes. I try to get 20 to 25 days of skiing a year out west. I think it's important, and I've kind of always done this from medical school on. Like, I would study for a test and bring note cards to the movie theater on a Wednesday night. I really think it's important to manage your energy. There's a lot, you know, wellness and work-life balance, a lot of it is how you manage your energy, right? So I do two PAOs a day because I know I don't have the energy to do a third, although we probably could. I just don't think it's fair to the patient. Or then the next day I'm worn out. So how I do work-life balance is I take plenty of time of vacation with my family. I come to meetings, so I get energized when I'm at this meeting. And I just make sure to meter what I do in a given week. So I'm not overworked in a way. So there's so many cases I feel like I can do effectively in a week, or PAOs or stuff. And I monitor that and make sure that I keep my energy level up and my interest up. And that's how I maintain work-life balance.
And with that, I think I let you have your life back. And we.
It's a beautiful day.
It's a beautiful
day. Go see the mountains.
And I think I let you go see the mountains. So thank you so much for spending time with me. I look forward to meeting you again in the future.
All right. Thank you.
Listeners, I really hope you enjoyed the episode with Dr. Ernie Sink. I learned a huge amount when I sat down with him, and I hope you have too. Please tune into our next episode in a couple of weeks. And again, please like, share, and subscribe to our podcast, and rate it on all apps, including the Apple iStore. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.